This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Julian Ng, and this is The Morning Run, taking all the way from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. this morning. It's the 17th of April, a Monday, which some people begin the week. Monday is always the start of everybody's week, I guess. But they begin the week feeling a little moody and blue. But not us, I don't think. I don't know. What about you, Julie? I mean, do you start the week, you know, full of energy and hope, and does that just go up and up and up, or does it sort of taper? Do you have a little bump?
I guess it changes as the day goes on. My mood turns for the better, but you know, it starts off with it being very heavy and depressing.
Does it?
But that's fine.
But that's work time. You don't sound weighed down or depressed.
It's turning. I think it's taking a turn for the better.
Okay, so clear your throats. If you're in your car, drive safely. And if you're at home, make that cup of coffee as strong.
That always helps.
Doesn't it? We always have a pot of coffee brewing in the office. It's kind of the smell of it wafts across the office. Now, we have a lineup for you this morning that you'll be talking about all day, Julian.
Right.
And I think you're going to provide some of that food for thought for the rest of the day with your interview with Dato' Reza Rafiq, Chief Executive of the Northern Corridor Implementation Authority. That's because after the 8 a.m. bulletin.
That's right. The NCIA is the statutory body responsible for establishing and implementing the Northern Corridor Economic Region's directions and policies. And it's been tasked to get in some investments totaling just under 200 billion ringgit over 18 years from 2007 to 2025. And I remember when all these corridors were set up.
And there are quite a number of them, aren't there?
Yeah, for basically covering every region in Malaysia. I guess they can use that motto, no Malaysian left behind. You know, you'll be covered by a corridor.
So this is, on one hand, you know, you might criticize it as being kind of purely aspirational.
I wasn't.
I'm speaking in the kind of abstract, one could say that. But the other thing is the aspiration itself, I think, is a laudable one in that, you know, often, you know, sort of when you look at capitalist systems, what is striking is the unevenness of development that it causes, right? So you have regions that are highly developed with huge amounts of investments, and then you have those who are, in fact, left behind. And so if a government, the state comes in and says, okay, we're going to try and regulate the market to the extent that we can, and encourage a much more even development process across, in this case, across the nation, isn't that laudable?
Yeah, I think that that word development is a highly contentious word because really you must define what exactly development is. In my mind, development is a place where people get the equal access to education, have a degree of happiness, has a degree of quality of life, while some other people would define it as a place where it's economically vibrant and people have access to jobs that would support their livelihood and their well-being. And with the latter definition, I think it's pretty hard to conform with this idea that if you build, they will come. It all depends on how much business you get out of that. It doesn't mean that if you build something, you will get the business and people would come. But nevertheless, that's the tack that the government has taken. They want to achieve 177 billion of investments over 18 years, and that results in an average of 10 billion ringgit per annum average, just under. Whether the government can achieve that and whether it will lead to anything.
Yeah, I think the other thing, of course, is numbers. We always look at numbers to kind of demonstrate that a particular proposal has worked. I believe there are some numbers related to the amount of investments that have been made in this northern corridor. The question, of course, is that if there wasn't a stated corridor, would those investments have happened anyway? I mean, what is it that the investment corridor itself, how much can we attribute to these numbers? the aspiration or the call for a Northern Corridor or any of these corridors.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it should be more than just a mere property project, a mere property development project. Well, it has to be something more than that.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, Julian, one of the major corridors, I think, that achieve kind of global status or at least visibility and status was the multimedia super corridor, right? And that's one of the big corridors. In fact, I believe last year Wired magazine wrote a piece, got basically an obituary for the MSC. I don't know to what extent, you know, we took it up. I know we did talk about this particular piece. I mean, not to say that, you know, Wired has the last say on anything, but did it generate a conversation about what was the thinking behind the corridor? What did it really achieve in the 20 years that passed? And, you know, and now this, I guess, as a successor to the MSC, isn't it?
Yeah, I think even after two decades, the intentions of the MSC is still nebulous at best. But, you know, Dr. Reza Rafiq, I must tell you, he has had a brush with the MSC because, more than a brush actually, because he was the chief executive of CyberView Sunaran Berhad. In fact, he was a COO for CyberView Sunaran Berhad for 2 years and 7 months. And he was also involved in CyberJaya, the development of CyberJaya Sunaran Berhad for another five years. So he was pretty much in the thick of when it was happening. And perhaps we can pose that question to him as well.
Yeah, very interesting. Oh, by the way, Julian, we actually have a poll going already this morning. And this is a reflection on something that happened last week, which is a young woman was fined in a magistrate's court for attempting suicide. And I think it generated a lot of conversation about the laws. I mean, we have laws that criminalize suicide. And then, of course, that against some professionals, mental health care professionals say, well, this is not necessarily helpful. And I think there's an interesting conversation here. So we have a poll. And it's an ask, basically, should self-harm be a crime? We put the links to some of the stories and some of the conversations already ongoing. And we give you several options. There are two yeses and two possible nos. This is just to kind of like get some a sense of what's really behind people's vote. So yes, it should be a crime because it's the law. And then we have yes, it should be a crime because your body is not your own. It belongs to, and in this case, I put there God. Or no, because we should show compassion. People are, you know, distressed and it's a mental or emotional, psychological condition. Or no, it's your right, which is kind of a different argument. We're just saying, well, your body is your own. And if you choose to harm yourself, that essentially that's your starting point in discussion. You have a right to kill yourself. So we put all those options
out there.
So
this poll will give you a lot more freedoms than the kind of freedom that you have to take away your own life.
Well, I mean, you know,
more choices here.
Yeah, the more choices. I mean, okay, it is in that sense. I mean, it's only a Twitter poll after all. But so far, we have 17% saying yes. Accumulation, but 34% of people saying yes, it should be a crime. Half and half in terms of whether it's because of law, but because of some notion of the spiritual or divine nature of your body or relationship to God or whatever. And then 33% saying no because you should show compassion. 33% saying no because it's your right. So
we have 2/3 of the pollsters currently, all of 6 votes of them agreeing that this should be a kind of right.
It's 10 minutes past 6, Julian. Of course, there's 6 votes. But, you know, as all our polls, you know, it's not perhaps representative of a national sample in terms of voting or thinking, but it's an interesting snapshot of how people think. So if you have any opinions about this matter, you can always WhatsApp us at 016-201-9000. Again, I'll say that again, 016-201-9000. Or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. And good morning to those who are sending us messages. Samuel Tan, good morning. Thank you very much. Please join the poll. Okay, so you have your breakfast grill, 8 to 8.30. And after the 8.30 bulletin, we have a discussion of the employment insurance scheme bill. And of course, you know, that is an interesting discussion.
Another hot potato.
It is a hot potato for so many reasons, including the fact that it's kind of an acknowledgement that we're going to have an unemployment issue on our hands. We're going to have increased retrenchments. It's also taking money out, as it were, disposable income is going to be reduced somewhat. And then what is the consequence of that? Right?
Yeah. I hope it's not too much money taken out of the employees. Because I think that the government should establish some kind of policy on social safety net, if only as a gesture, you know, put some bite behind those kind of gesture and not overtax, not turn this into somewhat an indirect tax on the people.
Right.
Somebody has got to fund this, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the idea is that it gets funded by everybody through deductions from your wage bill and with contributions from employers. So employees, I think, will contribute to this. It basically another part of
I think
of
it's
your,
still not decided yet. I think yeah. it's still up in the air at
up
the
in
moment.
The air. Yep. But that seems to be the model. I mean, only, you know, maybe in the last year, the government pushed for allowing you to choose to have more money in hand as opposed to contributing to your EPF, again, you know, as an attempt to help people with the cost of living issues, the rising cost of living, but also perhaps, you know, giving a kickstart or, you know, giving some push behind consumer spending in order to generate the economy.
Yeah, I'm actually more in favor of the idea that it should come out of the employers rather than the employees, you know, where they would give a few bucks for each employee every month just to support an insurance scheme like this, because I think that the government is also in the process of reducing corporate taxes. And this is a kind of reduction of the taxes that's not in lockstep with the cost of the EIS, because the cost of the EIS is finite, is limited, wouldn't dent the P&L account as much as a rise in taxes were. So the benefits of tax reduction would overpower whatever cost that would come out of this EIS.
Okay, so we look forward to that discussion. Also, this morning on our regular Monday Pressing Matters show, we have P. Gunasegaram. He'll be discussing the demerger of Sime Darby, asking whether the demerger will create value or not. He also looks at Petronas and its Philharmonic Orchestra, the MPO, and what he thinks is one of its greatest localization failures. And I think that's going to be an interesting discussion, because when you talk about music and world-class music or quality music, whatever, you know, can localization be your prime agenda in something like that?
Because it costs a lot of money to fund the Philharmonic Orchestra with all the foreigners. So, and basically, I hear murmurs of complaints that because of the ringgit weakness, these musicians are complaining that they're not paying up to their international counterparts.
Well, you know, I mean, look, this would be true of even your guy from Bangladesh or Vietnam or who works here. If the currency exchange, yeah, I mean, for a Bangladeshi, over the last 2 years, he's lost 30% of the value of his remittances because the taka has, you know, strengthened. But I think so those guys aside, you know, I mean, that issue aside, there is really a question of something like the MPO. What is it, you know, if you want to create an experience for the listener and you want to expose people to great music and great quality music, and a lot of, you know, a lot of young Malaysians are targeted in their outreach program. So there's a lot of talk about where this is going. It's not just for the elite. You know, it does have a knock-on effect, they claim. Right.
Well, the tickets are very expensive, so it cuts out a big swath of Malaysians trying to get in there. I do think that the question of whether there is enough localization or local content of the MPO is a very important one, because as you say, Sharad, what exactly is the raison d'etre of this of this orchestra?
Yeah, and I think localization perhaps is one of the things to justify the cost. At any rate, we'll be back with more news after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues, and that was the very mellow The Mystic by Van Morrison, one of my favorite singers.
Of your favorites? Or
yeah,
not?
One of my favorites. Brown Eyed Girl, I think, is one. That's a little more upbeat, I think, if I remember correctly. It's a little more upbeat. At least more upbeat than that, The Mystic. We left with a little discussion about the multimedia super corridor and corridor, our corridor aspirations. I'm going to tweet out a link to that WIRED story that I mentioned that we were talking about just now, Julian. It's just to so that if you haven't read that piece, you can do so. Also, just to note in the news overnight, because the stunning victory by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in that referendum that gives him more power, at least that's one frame understanding. Those who support him say it's not about giving him power. It's about changing Turkish politics for the better, moving Turkey towards a presidential system, a fuller presidential system.
And yeah, it seems like such a big blow to democratic reforms in a country like Turkey, because they are a NATO member, NATO ally. They are also an EU aspirant. They're also a key strategic member to fight against the IS scourge. So I think what Erdogan is doing is that he's parlaying his strategic position for more power in Turkey. Seems like quite a sad thing to do.
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, you know, about a year ago, on The Breakfast Grill, I interviewed a Turkish journalist, writer, Mustafa Akyol, a fascinating discussion where basically he outlines this turn where Turkey, as an aspirant towards joining Europe, really was making strides towards aligning itself on all kinds of indices, including, you know, human rights and, you know, freedom of expression and such. But, you know, it was a difficult conversation with Europe. In Europe, you know, and there were a lot of pushback against Turkey's membership, a full membership of the EU and Europe. And I think that, along with some geopolitical changes, really dampen those aspirations. And so Turkey really has taken a turn towards the authoritarian, at least as some people see it. You know, he is going to be in power or in office till 2029.
See, one can't look at this referendum with a straight face and say, oh, yeah, this might be an okay thing to consider, because you really question the motives of, behind a referendum like this.
He'd be like president for life. But he's now 63, and a quick calculation will show that he'll be 75 in 2029. So he's going to be in power for the next 12 years, you know, all things being equal. And it was a very near vote. I mean, the Yes campaign won 51% or 51.37% of the vote, and the No campaign was 48.63%.
There are, of course, allegations of cheating as well.
There are allegations, and I think there's going to be some challenge. But, you know, and like the British, you know, Brexit vote, you know, a win is a win. I mean, in the democratic system, a win is a win.
As long as you have one vote more, right? This first past the post.
Yeah, absolutely. So, talking about, you know, making decisions and autonomy and, you know, an agency, there's, of course, this old question of suicide. We put out this poll to talk about something that happened last week, which was the news story that a woman had been fined 2,000 ringgit for attempted suicide. And, of course, she's not the first to find herself in hot soup because of an attempt to, you know, to kill herself or self-harm. There have been other instances. And there's been some discussion around this, Julie. I mean, okay, so we put out this poll, and the options are a few options now available. What's your own thinking about this? I mean, where would you, how would you vote?
Well, I mean, this is where that aphorism, you know, the law is an ass, rings through, right? Because I don't know where this motive of this law comes from, but I think that, you know, when a person is down, you shouldn't kick them where it hurts most, because they require help. I mean, imagine all these anti-suicide organizations like the Befrienders and Samaritans going with a strategy that, hey, if you want to kill yourself,
Be successful, or you get fined.
I mean, how can you take that kind of tack for people who already have a very serious problem? And these whole statistics coming out from the World Health Organization, like including that the rate of suicide among the young growing at a very, very alarming rate, one of the fastest growing groups. And 55% of suicides globally are the people are aged between 15 and 44. So clearly there is some other underlying problem behind why a person wants to commit suicide.
Yeah. Okay. So some of the, in fact, we have a national registry. You know, it's a national suicide registry. Has recorded in Malaysia 1.3 deaths for every 100,000 in 2012. I don't know. That's not the, well, 2012 is like 5 years ago. So I'm not quite sure if we have more up to date information on the national suicide registry. But what's clear is that the law, as you put it, you know, Julian, is very clear. Section 309 of the Penal Code states that any individual attempts to commit suicide is punishable up to a year in jail or a fine or both. So in which case, if you were put in jail, they would have to put you on suicide watch to prevent you from killing yourself, having been convicted of trying to kill yourself. I mean, I'm not trying to make light of this, but it does seem it goes back to our deeper philosophical issues.
I think it's a ridiculous law. I think that our resources can be spent better elsewhere or improved as far as this, how we handle suicide is concerned.
Okay, but so there will be arguments that say, to the extent that the law exists, the courts have to and the police have to abide by it. That's one thing. But you're hoping for discretion on the part of the magistrate, right? So in this case, could the magistrate have reprimanded the young woman, reminded her of the law, but sent her away without something a punitive like a 2,000 ringgit fine, which, you know, does seem quite considerable?
I don't know whether the word clemency exists in the law, right? I mean, this is one of those instances where the idea and the notion of clemency can be used. But I'm not a lawyer, neither am I a legal expert, whether the judge has enough wiggle room to do that.
Well, you see, so what kind of argument can you make on behalf of the law? You could say that public resources are used as a consequence of your act. So if you endanger yourself, say, for instance, you climb out on the ledge of a building and you attempt to commit suicide, and the fire brigade has to come, and, you know, there's a lot of disruption, and so time and money is being spent on you because you've attempted suicide. Should you, in some sense, pay for that, you know, and should that you be punished for that?
I don't know. I think that's silly. I'm sorry, but we haven't even begun to address smoking in public areas, double parking. You know, when you have your car running, the pollution, that the ambient pollution, how we treat our neighbors. You know, there are a million and one things that we can put our minds to of kicking a person who's trying to kill themselves where it hurt most.
So here's a question of priority. But there also are people who argue, some 13% in our survey that shows that people do consider the human body something that belongs not to you, essentially, but to your God. And so you don't have the right. And I think, you know, you're asking for where this thinking comes from. I think at least in European countries, it would have come from the church, right? So the Christian church, you know, has always seen suicide as a sin. Right. And you know, I think if you kill yourself, you're not allowed to be buried on church ground. I don't know if that's still true today, but that might be where this law comes from. So I think people who have that religious framework might actually take that perspective.
Yeah, I think just a note on that, Sharada. In many parts of the world, the dogma of the religious institutions are changing as well, especially when you talk about Christendom and how, for example, Catholicism is trying to grapple with a lot of these modern issues, like whether there should be gender equality in the clergy, whether they should accept gays, you know, things like that. And for a matter like suicide, I think that's low-hanging fruit for these religious institutions.
I actually don't know what it's like in other religious traditions, but this conversation continues. Remember, join us on that Twitter poll. And now we go to the news, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was Call My Name by the extraordinary voice and talent of Prince. Or should I just issue a series of images and emojis?
I know what you mean, because Prince changed his name at one stage.
Yeah,
people didn't know what to call him.
Yeah, you know, he was going out with Sheena Easton for a long time.
I think
that the relationship broke up on him saying that they should communicate telepathically, and I don't think she went for that, you know. She's the kind of morning reading, train kind of girl.
You've been she waits reading for old issues of E! Magazine or something.
Or something, Dolly. Okay, Julian Ng, myself, Sharad Kutan. It's now the 17th, well, not now the 17th of April. It is the 17th of April, and it's now coming up to 42 minutes past 6. Remember, we have a Twitter poll going on the question of suicide, and should it be criminalized, or do you think, in fact, either that we should show more compassion or that it's your right to take your life if you choose to. So that's going. So far, about a third of people believe we should follow the law for whatever reason, keep it a crime. 42% saying we should show compassion, and about a quarter of the people thinking that, in fact, it's your right over your body. So join that Twitter poll. Also in the news, because looking at some of the big stories that have happened over, we've been talking endlessly about the missing individuals. There were five at last count, and now it's come down to four because Peter Chong has reemerged. And it's going to be a story with some interesting dimensions, because he's now claiming that he was kidnapped in Hajai. And not here, though some people might not buy that story. So we wait to see how this unfolds.
A lot of explaining to do by Peter Chong.
Absolutely, because so much concern about him, and also linking it to the other cases. Now, there's no lack of controversy globally. I think that's the nature of so much social media. It is, in fact, driven, you know, fueled by controversy, not least by people who, in fact, strive to create controversy.
Seek out controversy.
Gordon Ramsay, because celebrity chef and, you know, kind of...
always in a bad mood, right?
But yeah, he's a difficult number, but because he's so potentially nasty and cantankerous, that people are drawn to him, aren't they?
I think he uses that as a kind of publicity that to generate more views, more attention.
Yeah, and the question is, why are people attracted to that? I mean, is there a kind of masochistic strain in us that we want to be abused?
Because it's more honest, because every one of us would know a person like that. To see it on national TV is just something else.
Okay, so the most recent controversy is when he apparently has this service, I don't know if you call it a service, on Twitter, where you send him an image of your food and then he makes a comment on it. Is that how it works?
Yeah, it's usually a kind of truculent, a damning comment about your cooking, when you prepare breakfast or lunch or even a small snack. Send a picture to Gordon Ramsay and he would come back with some kind of statement to put you down, right? That's his trademark.
Okay, so in this instance, when the person did in fact send an image, and this was Indian food.
Ramis.
Yeah, it looks like vade, but soaked in lentil curry or something.
Well, according to the person who tweeted to Gordon Ramsay, an Indian national, who goes by the name of Ramis, and his handle is @sidechops, perhaps an Indian word, and he says, "Please rate my madhu vada sambar and nariyal chutney."
Okay, so the nariyal chutney, I think it's just coconut chutney, and the medu it's vade. See, here we would say vade. So it's vade plus sambar. Sambar would be your lentil soupy thing.
Nice.
Right? So there you have it. And then what does he say? He goes, so Gordon Ramsay's comment, clearly not on the taste because it's just an image he's looking at, because the vade is served on a tin plate. You know, your kind of ever silver, I don't know what they call it, stainless steel plate.
Yes.
That Indians love. Gordon Ramsay says, do you... What does he say?
I didn't know you can tweet from prison.
I didn't know you could tweet from prison.
And this just unleashed a whole lot of backlash from Indians, no less.
But not the person who tweeted him, right? The person who tweeted him actually was quite happy with the response, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think the whole intention of the original tweet was just to elicit a response from Gordon Ramsay. So he said, mission accomplished, and he was quite happy about it. So the question here, Sharad, and to everybody out there, is whether there are secret cows in comedy. And if you it is also a question of how seriously you
choose to take this. Yeah, okay, so what? So then you have all these earnest responses, like one who said, could a chef who's from a country that is the former colonizer of India and is currently home to more than 1.5 million Touché. British Indians seriously not know that, that Indian meals are often served on these metal plates called thali? And, so people took this seriously and are like, got very stroppy.
I like the colonial argument though. To that, I would say touche.
Yeah. He's Gordon Ramsay's been accused as a consequence of this tweet of ignorance and such. But it seems to me quite brilliant. I'm wondering if Gordon Ramsay actually does this all himself, or does he have like a little collective that tweets? Because it must be exhausting to come up with, clever.
I think it's
responses.
Just second nature for him. I think he has fun.
He does. Yeah.
No, but yeah, but Sharad, do you think that once you enter that zone, that you shouldn't be angry about such comments? Because is it really comedy, or should somebody like Gordon Ramsay show some degree of cultural sensitivity?
I think people, there are too many sensitive people in the world, and they too easily take offense. I mean, look, for instance, in Malaysia, right, we had this whole controversy about satire. We've had several politicians come out and saying satire is not our culture, ignoring a long history, both in Malay culture, Indian culture, Chinese culture, of being satirical. And said, well, once you're a politician, really, your skin should be a little thicker,
Yes.
And that's, you accept that. And so, the original satirical image that came out in the Chinese newspapers, I think, was Nanyang Xiangpao, isn't it?
The monkey pictures.
The monkey picture, right, which is a comment on what happened in Parliament over 355. Subsequently, Fahmi Reza has come out to do his own thing, again, making the head of the Islamic Party look like, our Simeon cousin. And so, he was trying to make the point that politicians shouldn't be so thin-skinned and should accept. Once you are in public office, you should be open to more scrutiny. You should be open to personal comments made about you. Because that's the nature of the job.
You know what they say, right? Don't get mad, get even.
And, I bet if they took power, they would get even with some people. I mean, all politicians do. But it's
what
true.
What I meant was not get even with, not get even with the apparatus of the law, right? Don't be a bully, but just get even with a degree of smartness or cleverness. Because you see, that going back to Gordon Ramsay, and again, tying in this whole conversation about suicide, this is not a life and death situation. This is perhaps a little bit of comedy, perhaps a little bit of bad cooking involved, because Gordon Ramsay has established a kind of branding that it is that kind of thing that he does. And the other people, I put another link there, Sharad, about how these other people send in their really pictures of horrible pictures of their cooking, perhaps acknowledge themselves as well by the sender. That they would get a certain response back by Gordon Ramsay. Yeah. And that should be it, right? It's all about fun.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so it's a people mistaking the genre they're in. They think this is, serious assessment of your culinary skills or the cuisine that you purport to represent, when in fact it's all just a bit of fun. And there are just too many humorless people.
And also the other thing, I think some criticism would go a long way in improving our lives, right?
Absolutely.
We need to live with that.
Absolutely. And that's what we in the media, live for. After all, what is the fourth estate but this endless production of, informed criticism. I think informed criticism, what we strive to achieve. Okay, we're coming up to the news at the top of the hour, but before that, we have Counting Crows and Accidentally in Love, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.